My name is Noel Joseph Terence Montgomery Needham. I'm from Great Britain. My Chinese name is Li Yue Sir. I have been to China 9 times in my life, and I am eternally grateful for everything I have learned there. Everywhere I have been able to witness its ancient spirit of science and technology. I feel privileged to have seen firsthand this wonderful creativity, the brightest of minds and the noblest of spirits. From this war-torn Asian country burst vitality that borders on the miraculous. It is in this land where such wisdom abounds that the second act of my life began. This is Sanwei Mountain in Dunhuang, Gansu Province. It stretches 60 kilometers, with the main peak facing the Mogao Caves. It's known as the first holy site of Dunhuang. In 1943, an Englishman climbed along the steep ridge to the temple on the mountaintop. Neglected and in disrepair, the small temple's state of dilapidation didn't dampen the Englishman's spirits at all. Before coming to China, he had been interested in the country for over 10 years and read many books about it. But China was like a jigsaw puzzle that he felt unable to complete. This handsome young man with his high bridge nose and intense gaze is Joseph Needham, who earned a PhD from Cambridge Biochemical Laboratory in 1924, later to become a Fellow of the Royal Society. It was the 8th month since Needham had left Britain for China. After Japan launched its invasion of China, Needham had sought permission from the British government to travel there. His brief was to see how Chinese academia and industry performed and could be helped in wartime. He had by now visited many universities, including National Southwest Associated University and the research institutes that had been relocated to Southwest China. This time, Needham was set to exploring China's Great Northwest, a key piece of the puzzle for him in understanding China. The Needham Research Institute in Cambridge still has the map he used.
This地址是李约瑟博士抗战时期的时候自己用的。我们怎么知道这个呢？因为你仔细的看就会看出来，他在上面就画了每一次的调查的路线。13年的9月份。 他就或者8月份，他决心哎，一定要往西北去，尽可能一直到著名的敦煌莫高石口去一趟，看一下。那他就是从重庆出发。This
is the route Joseph Needham planned. He'd cross the Sichuan Basin, the Qinling Mountains, the Los Plateau, and the Yellow River, before reaching the He-Xi Corridor, stretching between snow peaks and deserts, and on to Dunhuang. Like many other Western scholars, Needham viewed Dunhuang as a place of unique cultural importance in unlocking the secrets of the Silk Road during the heyday of ancient Chinese civilization. Thank you. He was further attracted to the great northwest of China for many other reasons. During wartime, many enterprises in areas occupied by Japan moved westward to safer areas away from the fighting. Industrial enterprises in papermaking, shoemaking, smelting, casting, and many other fields were established there. Gansu also boasted China's largest oil field. This was obviously important to his wartime mission. However, the journey from Chongqing to Dunhuang was over 2,000 kilometers with rugged mountain roads, the raging Yellow River, and finally, the vast and desolate Gobi Desert. The adventure was made more perilous by the possibility of air raids and the roving wartime bandits. Needham prepared with the prudence of a scientist and the astuteness of an adventurer. First, he had to find the vehicle that could adapt to the changing landscapes. The vehicle he settled upon was a 2.5-ton Chevrolet pickup from the Royal Air Force fleet. Even with the truck's insignia, there would be enough problems in dealing with bandits, disease, and strange dialects. Needham found a driver and an English-speaking assistant and stuffed the truck with every kind of tin food he could lay his hands on, including mustard, coffee, and chocolate. Having finally got himself fully ready, Needham set off for his epic journey on August 7, 1943. However, the ambitious travel plan suffered setbacks from the start, as Needham recorded in his diary. 12th of August, we adjusted the footbrake tightness. August 16th. Awful big washout. Lines of trucks and endless mule carts there all day. September 19th. Engine now running perfectly normal with full power. I drove on through the twilight. The gasket blew out. These trials and tribulations did nothing to dampen Needham's enthusiasm. These pictures were captured by Needham himself on the journey. This one shows how an English gentleman turns the hood of a truck into a makeshift dining table. A few pieces of bread with honey and a posy of wildflowers made a nice outdoor breakfast table. He fearlessly tested every kind of local delicacy he came across. From the southwest to the northwest. From stews and stir-fries to noodles, lotus roots, mushrooms, vegetables, soups, pancakes and flatbreads. His diary carefully notes his reaction, usually delicious or especially delicious. The flatbreads were a particular favorite. When one feels like a sweet taste, one goes to the drug shop and buys a jar of honey to eat with the cartwheel Gansu bread. A A fellow traveller remarked that Needham seemed to have a cast-iron stomach that could cope with almost any kind of food he encountered. If board was not a problem, lodging was more of a challenge. Typically, he'd find a space in a temple or yard, put up his camp bed, and hang the mosquito net. He'd sleep under the moonlight, with chickens and pigs strolling around his berth. After 10 days, Needham's battered truck arrived at the Liuho ancestral temple deep in the Qinling Mountains. He took many photos of the Taoist temple and praised it in his diary as a lovely place. Needham had long shown a sympathetic leaning towards Taoism. The Needham Research Institute preserves to this day the numerous seals, into which are carved dozens of Taoist names he gave himself.
这就是李约瑟博士收藏的五十种印章，其中的五六个，也应该是比较早的，因为这两个一个是李约瑟，一个是丹药，这两个就是他的名字和号。丹药是什么意思呢？就是说一个很善然的金丹跟炼丹术有关嘛。他以后也选了跟道教有关的另外一个号，就是生荣子，意思是可以克服混乱的能人的意思，就这个都是因为他对 道教和炼丹术是特别特别的感兴趣，对他来说，一开始学道家思想的时候，觉得哎，这个正好符合我对世界的看法和观点，所以就做了比较深刻的研究，不仅是炼丹方面，就也是道家思想方面的。
Giving himself Chinese Taoist names was just a symptom of his passion for Taoism that was Needham's real motivation. Years later, in Science and Civilization in China, he wrote 4 fascicules to Taoist alchemical practices, attracting criticism for his excessive focus on the topic. How did a scientist trained by modern Western thinking become a loyal Taoist?
As such, of course, includes so many varieties. Yes, certainly Joseph saw a lot of scientific work deriving from Taoist thought.
Embryology, Needham's research subject at Cambridge, reveals life as evolutionary rather than mechanistic. The Tao begets one. One begets two, two begets three, three begets the myriad creatures. Perhaps Needham found in these lines from chapter 42 of the Tao Te Ching a rationale that chimed with his own scientific outlook. Needham saw Taoism, or Taoism as it is now more commonly called, as a brilliant combination of philosophy and religion. The Tao represents the order of nature. Taoist temples are commonly called Guan, interpreted by Needham as observation, namely the observation of nature. For Needham, Taoism's emphasis on nature, along with the experimental spirit represented by Taoist alchemy, heralded a proto-scientific culture in China. Many of the more attractive aspects of Chinese culture are derived from Taoism. Taoism and Confucianism are, to this day, two pillars of Chinese thought. After a quiet night at Liu Ho Ancestral Temple, Needham set off early in the morning to Shuangshipu, a small town not far away. Needham was going to visit a much admired friend. These photos document the history of this unprepossessing cave house. Rowe Alley, the famous New Zealand educator and writer, first came to China in 1927. In 1940, to support China during the war, he founded the Pei Li Vocational Institute in this call in Fengxian County, Shaanxi Province. The institute enrolled kids from poor families and taught them Chinese, mathematics, geography, and other academic subjects. In addition, they acquired skills in areas like machinery, wool spinning, and chemistry. The aim was to cultivate talents for China's future, hence the name Pei Li, meaning cultivating for the future. Needham observed with great interest that in this remote village, Rowe Alley encouraged sickly children to exercise more to improve their health and personal hygiene. Professional teachers were hired for them. The focus was on cultivating both independence and team spirit. Needham was very impressed by what he saw and recorded as much as he could with his camera. To welcome Needham, the school had planned a special party. The night he arrived, he was greeted by dozens of young men, 15 to 16 years old, singing Northwestern folk songs. In return, Needham took off his army-style jacket, rolled up his sleeves, picked up a thick stick, and performed a wildly spinning traditional English Morris dance, also while singing. The students could only watch in amazement. In this Shaanxi cave dwelling, the two friends shared their concerns about the fate of China. Needham repaired the truck and encouraged Rowe Alley to join him on the expedition to Dunhuang. 2 days later, Needham and his friends were on the road again. The team had grown. Ali brought two of his students, Sun Guangjun and Wang Wensheng, along with him. They were all destined for Dunhuang. Heading northwest from the Qinling Mountains, they found themselves crossing pasture lands. Needham realized that sheep farming, rare in other Chinese regions, was happening on a large scale in the northwest. He believed it was necessary for China to dedicate large areas to animal husbandry to produce milk to supplement the nation's diet, which he saw as deficient in calcium. Passing by the Yellow River, he quickly noticed China's emphasis on flood control. Unlike Europe, China was regularly plagued by floods. So, whoever managed to control the waters would control the country.
Joseph was looking with his eyes widely open to see how the country was being operated, how activities were being controlled mechanically, with or without a scientific outlook, depending or not on scientific basis. Well, as I say, Joseph would have his eyes open in the countryside for how the farms were being worked, how the canals were being kept properly, how the bridges had been built. He was looking for that sort of practical, immediate, visible evidence.
I had other teachers who were good. They were good in different ways, but I think the person who showed the most passion for China was Joseph Needham. And I think Joseph Needham was consistently finding these different aspects to Chinese history and culture, which endlessly interested him.
The longer he stayed in China, the deeper his insight into the country became. His camera documented every detail of the way this ancient country ran. The homemade telegraph, the deep well digging method dating from the Song Dynasty several centuries ago, ancient papermaking, the sheepskin raft, the creaky spinning wheel. They were all captured in Needham's photographs. And all were observed from his unique perspective, shaped by his Western scientific mind. Besides scenery and technology, Needham often observed people. In Science Outpost, he described Chinese people in the following words. If at mealtime someone on the road pours out tea for them, they always hasten to hold the cup with both hands and bow before drinking. Westerners sometimes resent the curiosity of the crowd, but from the Chinese point of view, it is rather rude not to take an interest in other people's affairs. In actual fact, every coolie who may be wearing nothing but cotton shorts in the heat has, at his belt, his pouch containing his seal with the characters of his name on it. He would set his seal to a document as an individual. The clothes worn in general by the country people are a strange mixture, giving a curiously half-Greek, half-Jesuitical appearance. Then there are the patriarchs with white beards sitting on farmhouse steps exactly as if they had stepped out of a Greek chorus. Chinese ingenuity is displayed in the kind of food which even the poorer classes like to eat when they can, in spite of wartime privations. The Chinese have the French outlook towards food and drink. In Lanzhou, Needham bought himself a second-hand sheepskin coat. He had set off from Chongqing in the heat of summer. By the time he arrived in the Great Northwest, however, it was already late fall. The westbound team marched past Qinling Mountains, the Yellow River, and the Los Plateau, getting closer and closer to the narrow Hexi corridor. They abandoned the truck for horse, and then the horses for camels as they pushed on into the desert. Eventually, after about 2 months, they arrived at the long-anticipated Mo Gao Caves. On October the 1st, 1943, standing motionless in front of the Thousand Buddha Caves, Needham stared at the hills before him. The morning sun cast a golden light on the caves. On this first day of October, the hundreds of caves were bathed in a light which brought back the centuries. In his diary entry for that day, he wrote, Thousand Buddha Caves in Chinese characters with 3 exclamation marks. It was the first time he had used such punctuation in his notes, even when he had to sleep with the pigs or had been caught in a flood. His official government position gave him free access to the caves. He took hundreds of photos of the Thousand Buddha Caves. There were more than 400 caves with the remains of Buddhist statues, Buddhist hands and arms, and fragments of painted clay. The Mo Gao Caves are one of the greatest repositories of Chinese art and architecture. An excited Needham spent most of his time in the caves sketching murals and sculptures. Needham's sketchbook shows how he went about his research. On this page, he meticulously depicted the postures of dancing girls from the Tang Dynasty, together with the shapes of their fluttering dresses. He noted down the colors of each element of their clothing in English, along with the word music in Chinese. On this page, he sketched the armor on one of the murals and made a note in English, much earlier than medieval armor. Down below, he drew a bald, bearded man and wrote down his name in English. On this page, Needham captured the plump and graceful characters in the murals, noting such as Tang Dynasty or Apsara. He also sketched the honeycomb cottage in the murals. Later, this sketch, with the note Houses of the Common People, would be used in his book to illustrate the Tang society.
So he was very interested in seeing this fantastic Buddhist cave temple series of constructions, and he left some wonderful drawings. And he was clearly overwhelmed by the place.
Unlike ordinary travellers, Needham examined Dunhuang murals from the unique perspective of a scientist. His interest was in revealing the details of the operation of this ancient civilization and exploring applications of ancient science and technology. The illustrations in Science and Civilization in China incorporate many of Needham's observations in Mogao Caves. He saw something extraordinary in the forms of defensive buildings in ancient China, the methods of building pavilions, ship structure, and even in details such as the placement of harness. For more than a month in Dunhuang, Joseph Needham immersed himself in the magical world of Mogao murals during the day. At night, he often sat alone in the desert, looking up at the stars. Obviously, the impact of Dunhuang on him was enormous. He continually wrote down his discoveries and reflections. Rather than a closed universe of crystal spheres as believed by Westerners in the early days, the concept of an infinite universe had been born in China long ago. There were also star charts, the oldest in the world, fashioned in the Tang Dynasty between the 7th and 10th centuries, and showing the sky in the Northern Hemisphere, with the Big Dipper and Polaris as easily recognizable as they are in this morning's newspaper. In The Shorter Science and Civilization in China, Volume 2, Needham concluded that the Chinese were the most persistent and accurate observers of celestial phenomena anywhere in the world before the Arabs. But it did not appear necessary to them that truth should be expressed in the highly theoretical and geometrical form which was characteristic of the Greeks. This was why, some might say, that science had not existed in ancient China. Needham believed science belonged to all, and only when the scientific achievements of different civilizations were equally valued could mankind make progress through cooperation and unity. From science and technology to society, from society to culture, and from culture to civilization. The journey to Dunhuang allowed Joseph Needham to explore ever deeper into China. Meanwhile, the journey had quietly changed the fate of a group of people. This quaint courtyard was the temporary residence in Dunhuang for Needham and his friends. Sun Guangjun and Wang Wensheng, the two students from Peili Vocational Institute, were responsible for obtaining groceries and cooking. Needham taught the boys how to cook Irish stew. At that time, none of them realized that these weeks together would change the boys' lives forever. Seventy-year-old Zoe Reed, who lives on the outskirts of West London, is chair of the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding. In 1965, before the establishment of the formal diplomatic relations between Britain and the People's Republic of China, Needham took the lead in setting up the society to establish friendship and cooperation with China in a wide range of fields such as culture and academia. Raised in Britain, Zoe looks Oriental, and her father is one of those two boys.
So in here you can see a picture of my father that was actually taken by Joseph Needham. And you can see my father, he's about 15 or 16 there, and he's got bits of a camel on his back, bits of the bones.
Needham would fund Sun Guangjun and his travelling companion, Wang Wensheng, to go to study in Britain. In 1947, Sun Guangjun, then 21, went to Britain to study textile technology at the Cooperative College in Manchester, where he met and fell in love with a British classmate.
So this is actually this big photograph here, which is of the 1949 Cooperative College yearbook, is the only picture I've got of the two of them together. So my mother is in the front row, one of only three female students, and my father is in the back row, one of about 100 male students. So there was quite a chance she was going to find a boyfriend, I think, there.
The unexpected journey to Dunhuang changed Sun Guangjun's life. Needham maintained a lifelong friendship with his family. When Sun Guangjun's daughter Zoe got married, Needham selected a piece of silk cloth made in Hangzhou, China, as her wedding gift.
It's very beautiful. This is a wedding album, and in it somewhere I've got the card he sent. Or is it in the other one? No, here it is. So it says, a little wedding present for Zoe Kim Reed Poxton from Joseph and Doffy Needham from the Hangzhou Silk Mills, 5th of October 1980. I think it was one of the trips, I think they were over there. I think he was saying they were going over there. And so they bought the wedding present while they were over there and then brought it back for me.
Today, Joseph Needham's portrait still takes pride of place in Zoe's family photo album.
And the final picture I put in the book was this photograph that she loved, and on the back it says, for dear Susan, Joseph Needham, 1992. Without Joseph, there would be no me, that's for sure.
Zoe has been the chair of the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding since 2009. In 2013, she led a British delegation to retrace the route of Needham's journey to northwest China and saw Dunhuang for herself. Needham's journey in the 1940s changed not only the lives of two Chinese teenagers, but also the fate of the Mogao Caves. At the end of 1943, shortly after leaving Dunhuang, Needham wrote to Fu Sunyan and Chun Li Fu, then Minister of Education, calling for the establishment of an institution jointly managed by the Ministry of Education and Academia Sinica to protect Dunhuang. On January the 1st, 1944, 2 months after Needham left Dunhuang, the National Research Institute on Dunhuang Art was formally established in the courtyard where he had stayed.